How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well and staying safe. The end of the world is hitting the DMV right now. The sky is pitch black, and it's really windy, so this might be our last show. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking to a really interesting guy, Adrian Miller. David turned me on to him. He is a lawyer. He's a food historian. He's a policy wonk. He is a soul food scholar, as he calls himself. And he is the author of Black Smoke, African Americans, and the United States of Barbecue, a really fabulous, fascinating, untraditional book. We're going to have a special guest appearance by Michael Sands from Calvert Woodley. When we're going to check in on our friends at Calvert Woodley and La Cheeserie. And joining us tonight, we've got Claude doing all the important work. David is back. And our favorite Renaissance man, Nevin Martel. Nevin, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to hang out with you guys, even when the world's ending.
Is it you're part of the DMV too?
Yeah, no, I'm in Silver Spring. And it does look like all the worst parts of the Book of Revelations are unfolding in the sky above us.
And I don't know about you guys, but every device I have is buzzing and screaming. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, even when you turn them off. Nevin, what is, I'm looking in the background of your room there. Is that an album cover?
That's an album. This is Gil Scott Heron's last record before he unfortunately passed away. Uh-huh. This is a deluxe reissue they put out a couple of years after his passing. And, you know, his music is something I found great solace in during the pandemic. And so when I saw that they had done a deluxe reissue of the record, I kind of had to jump on it and, you know.
Nice, it's a nice look.
So yeah,
you're a foodie, you're a travel guy, you're a photographer, you're a dad. As the city starts to come back post pandemic, fingers crossed, what are you most looking forward to?
You know, to be honest, you know, I think a lot of people are looking to be back in a normal life again when it comes to dining out and going out. And you know, for a number of reasons, that's just not going to happen right away or anytime soon, really, just because there's a massive shortage of workers in the hospitality industry. There's a lot of shortages when it comes to the supply chains in terms of the ingredients that restaurants use. And, you know, there's still a lot of hesitancy for people working in restaurants about, you know, health and safety concerns. So though I am excited to get back out and do that kind of stuff, I understand that the restaurant experience is not going to be the same. There's going to be a lot of stresses that didn't exist before the pandemic that you're going to have to cope with now. To be honest, my real like kind of fingers crossed is like getting to travel again, you know, like being able to like get out into the world and explore places I haven't been and like, you know, really be a little bit more intentional about getting to those bucket list places than I was say in the end of 2019, you know, when I was like, oh, it'll happen. And now, oh no, I have to like make a plan. I have to make it happen or else it doesn't happen.
Well, and go now. As David and Claude know, my husband and I went to Greece a couple weeks ago.
Oh my God. I've heard so many great things about Greece right now.
Spectacular. And they're so happy to see you.
Of course, bring your dollars.
So happy to see you and to be in some of those spectacularly beautiful historic places and have it all to yourself.
That's what I've heard that, you know, it's open in terms of the restaurant, so you can still get the kind of hospitality you're looking for. And like the friends that I had that just went, they were like, it's amazing to walk these places that are normally just mobbed. And really be alone for this essentially, which is great.
It kind of spoiled us on everything. Okay, David, closer to home, big Supreme Court decision today. 9-0, as we were saying before the show, I think it's been a while since the Supreme Court has been 9-0 on anything.
Yeah.
And this was the NCAA losing big time in the compensation battles with students. But can you give us the snapshot version of what this was about?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, the Supreme Court said two things. Number one, to the NCAA, they said, number one, you're in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Right.
Number two, why are you even bringing this to the court? Because we can very easily rule that all of your kind of artificial boundaries and artificial restrictions on athlete income are illegal. All of them.
Right.
So it was as clear a message to the NCAA as possible that they need to get their stuff together and you know, find something that works for these student athletes in terms of, you know, their marketing, their likenesses and all these things so that they can get paid a living wage. I mean, they literally said, you know, you cannot violate antitrust law and deny people a living wage.
Yeah.
Or deny people a wage at all for their labor.
Right. So will the NCAA get smart? I doubt that. But will they get smart and say, okay, we now have to get ahead of this and let's get ahead of the inevitable. If universities are going to make billions of dollars off their images, off their likenesses, off what they do on the field and the court, we're going to pay them something. Yeah. Are they going to get ahead of this or will they get
dropped? They've been doing, you know, they've allowed student athletes, you know, starting in the next year or two to kind of make deals locally with their likenesses. If Joe or Jane athlete is in a college town and they're a big deal in that college town, they should be able to make a deal with the local car dealership, take a picture and say, hey, I'm Joe Jones or Jane Jones. And these cars are pretty cool. And I have one and you should get one too. And get paid for that. Like everybody else would get paid for that. And so they're already doing a likeness thing. I mean, again, I'm not an expert on this, but it just seems, but from what I understand, the likeness thing is going forward. That's starting already. But the ramifications for this one are pretty big.
Yeah.
You know, and again, 9-0 is not ambiguous, you know?
I know. And what do we make of it when Brett Kavanaugh is articulating so clearly just how ludicrous the situation has been for so long? That was something. Haven't some individual states already started to take some action? Didn't California, for instance, some months ago say?
Yeah. Been big on this for years. They've been doing this. They've gotten out in front of it and told student athletes that, you know, giving them more leeway to kind of make as much money as possible under the rules for their likeness. And, you know, and that has created the question of competitive advantage for schools in California that can offer these things.
So
there has to be a uniform set of standards for this to make any sense, for this thing called the NCAA to make any sense.
Yeah.
And if they keep messing around, the Supreme Court's going to say the NCAA is illegal and you need to, and it needs to end.
That's what you kind of heard, but reading between the lines today, that's what you kind of heard.
Yeah.
It's spectacular. Okay. Travel question, Nevin. Tokyo announced that fans will be allowed in the stands at the Olympics. Would you go?
Absolutely not. I have no interest in being one of the 10,000 there. I think it's a bad look that it's even happening, frankly. You know,
I agree.
I just don't think that it needs to happen. You know, I don't know what the rules are in terms of if you cancel your Olympics when you get to get the makeup, Olympics, but I don't think it's a good look for them. And I think it's also just a huge health hazard. So you would not see me in those stands, even if I got a ticket.
I think there's just zero excuse for Japan being as far behind as they are in vaccinations. Last time I heard, which was a couple of days ago, it was something like 4%.
Yeah, crazy.
And I say this as some, I wrote a story about their basketball league, and this was a year ago almost, really being way behind most of the other organized basketball leagues in the world in terms of getting their players vaccinated, expressing the importance. And they started to do it, but Nevin's exactly right. And I've done 3 Olympics and it is a walking Petri dish.
At the best of times.
It's not good. Right?
Would you go, David, if you say you were working for ESPN or TNT or something and they said, we want you to go, would you go?
No.
Yeah.
Not this time.
I agree.
I can't.
Don't need to.
Yeah. The juice isn't worth the squeeze to me. Yeah. Now, if I had never gone and had never done one before, maybe I'd think differently, but I kind of doubt it. There are so many people that you come in contact with when you're at an Olympic Games that you have no idea where they're from. You have no idea where they've been. You don't know anything about them. And that's part of the charm of the Olympics is, hey, you meet all these people from around the world and it's wonderful. And that's normally great, except for right now. It's not so great.
Right. Yeah.
Time to have an Olympic Games.
We could go on, but we won't because I see Michael and we've got a couple things Claude and I want to talk about. But with these variants that are out there now, these incredibly powerful variants, terrifying. Okay, so nobody go to Tokyo for the Olympics. Watch on TV. Okay, one little piece of housekeeping. I have to remind everybody about the summeroflittles.com. August 7th, go to summeroflittles.com. You too can go to one of the 20 plus venues around the country on August 7th. By the way, if you see an arc going behind me, it's because the rain is incredible here.
Yeah, it is really
good here.
So if we survive, go to the summeroflittles.com 3rd annual reunion on August 7th. I'm going to save Ed's review for another time. Claude and I have an important announcement, and I'll just tee this up a little bit, Claude, in that Claude and I are often talking about how can we make the show better. We're always reaching out to listeners, to featured authors, to every friend and family member of the show saying, okay, how can we make it better? What can we do to keep things going, to be even more engaged with our listeners? And what we've come up with is Patreon. And we are going to try a small, contained Patreon setup for the fans of Chatter on Books. And Claude, you want to tell us how this is going to work?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, you know, you go to patreon.com/chatteronbooks and you get all kinds of special stuff. I mean, bonus content from the show, that's pre-stuff, post-show stuff, stuff that, you know, that we talk about before the show, which sometimes is more fascinating. Well, I won't say more fascinating than the show, but oftentimes it's just as fascinating as the stuff we talk about on the show. But also you get to watch the show virtually once a month. And we're going to do a Chatter on Books virtual book club and all of that with your Patreon membership. And David Aldridge will come over to your house and watch the NBA Finals with you. You his expert,
exactly.
Expert commentary.
What?
Yeah.
Well, why wasn't I told about this?
We haven't talked to him about that yet, so we'll see if that comes up.
Well, and you know, God willing, fingers crossed, we will start doing this show in person occasionally, not all the time, because the Zoom situation works pretty well for a lot of people. But hopefully we'll do some things in person. That'll be part of it as well. So there's that. Okay, Michael Sands from Calvert Woodley, thanks for joining us, my friend.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Good to see you. How are you? You look like you're in a witness protection program, my friend.
my son's in town, so I didn't go into work today.
Good for you. Okay, speaking of work, how is Calvert Woodley? How are all our friends? How are things coming out of the pandemic?
Good. Other than this storm we're having right now, no, we're
storm. We're
everyone, well. No one can see this because they're listening. But just so you know, we're all looking up at the sky as we talk.
Yeah, it's pretty tremendous, actually. We are doing well. We've been very, very fortunate, all things considered, and we're doing well. So thank you.
Fortunate, but I remember when the pandemic first started, you and the gang there took it very, very seriously and you shut down completely and you took very, very good care of your staff. So it's not just luck. I think you put a lot of effort into that. Are there any things that you implemented during the pandemic, whether it's curbside pickup or deliveries or any things you implemented during the pandemic that you're going to continue because your customers who are very loyal said, we love that?
Well, curbside for sure. It's something that, you know, was sort of becoming a thing before COVID. And then, you know, it took about 10 minutes for it to realize that it was worth having and worth keeping. And I think curbside is here to stay for everybody, I would assume.
Yeah. I can't imagine ever going into the grocery store on a regular basis anymore.
I remember at the beginning of COVID, after the NBA canceled their season and things went really crazy before we went curbside only, I saw you I think you came in the store and I said, you know, we are really, really, really busy. It's crazy. And I don't think it's going to keep up. I was just hoping we're going to stay in business, you know, given all the stuff. And you said, oh, I think you guys are going to be all right. And I said, I don't know, as a pessimist, I guess, you know, and you said, I think you guys are going to be busy for a long time. And you were right. So we're very lucky.
Because a lot of people, myself included, my family drank way too much for the first 4 months of the pandemic. And then we realized it wasn't like a snowstorm. That was my family's entire attitude for the first few months of the pandemic. Oh, there's like a snowstorm and you hang out and you stay up too late and you play Monopoly and you drink too much. And then we had to have a come to Jesus meeting about 4 months in. But what did people drink the most of during the pandemic?
I would say that liquor probably outpaced wine slightly more than it typically does.
Yeah.
It was fairly consistent, to be honest. Our numbers sort of skew about even with wine and liquor and then, you know, the assorted other cheese and food and beer and things, but, it may be skewed a little heavier towards liquor, but not by a whole lot.
There you go. Okay. I know you have to go off to some pretentious wine dinner soon, but coming up right after you is Adrian Miller, our soul food scholar. And he knows everything there is to know about soul food, about barbecue. So if I walked into Calvert Woodley and said, okay, we're doing barbecue, Adrian Miller's coming over to cook. It's going to be fabulous. David's going to come over and watch. What kind of wine, what kind of beer would you tell us to have?
I would first ask what you prefer, because I don't think that one necessarily, well, I probably think beer goes better, but if, you know, listen, I'm a big believer in drink what you like, not necessarily what someone tells you goes better.
Not necessarily matching it up with a food.
Yeah, I mean, I like wheat beer. I like, you know, lighter beers. You know, if someone recommended a big, heavier brown ale or something that probably goes better with barbecue, I personally would still probably choose what I like. But, but if you're asking, you know, what goes well with beer, a brown ale, like a Newcastle brown ale, something with a little bit of body, maybe even a little bit of that, you know, molasses caramelly type quality that a lot of the barbecue sauces have. But you get different, there's different styles of barbecue. There's the dry rub and there's, Memphis, and then there's the sauce. So it depends. Certain beers can go better, like a lighter wheat beer or a pale ale.
Yeah. You like that recommendation, Nevin? Do you agree?
I do. You know, I'm a big believer like you, Michael, that it's what you like to drink that makes the biggest difference. To be honest, though, like when I'm eating barbecue, there's usually always bourbon involved. That to me is kind of a classic pairing, whether you have it straight up in a cocktail. That to me, I just kind of like the kind of the flavors in the way they interplay between kind of like the smoke and the heat of the meat and what's happening in the glass too. So that's kind of my go-to. To be honest, sometimes, I'll just have a beer or I'll just have whatever the host is serving because, you know, I'm not too picky. I just want to have a good time and hang out with people when I'm eating barbecue.
There you go.
Yeah. If you're real wine, something with some real fruit and some body, like maybe a Zinfandel, if you want American, you could do a Malbec from Argentina. You could do a Beaujolais, something lighter and fruity, but just something that has a little bit of, upfront fruit that would sort of stand up to the sauce.
Mm-hmm. Only Michael Sands can say upfront fruit with a straight face.
Yeah.
Right. All right, I'm Michael.
I can tell you, Malbec goes with everything. That's right.
Michael, thank you for joining us. Go back to your witness protection program, your pretentious wine dinner, whatever it is, and tell everybody at Calvert Woodley you said hi. And everyone should go to Calvert Woodley. It's a fabulous place. And La Cheeserie, okay? Thanks, man.
Thank you, Tori.
See you later. We love you.
All right.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
All right. Now, as I'm listening to all these people talk about barbecue and soul food and beer and wine, I'm thinking Adrian Miller is up in my right-hand corner going, oh, my God, these idiots. They don't know what they're talking about. Adrian Miller, welcome to Chatter on Books. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be with you.
Are you in a part of the world that's not ending? Because our part of the world is ending right now as we speak.
Sure. Yeah, I'm in the Mile High City, Denver, Colorado. Things seem to be going well. So, we're going to keep it rolling as long as we can.
Good. Fingers crossed. Okay. So I seldom, when we have a guest on, an author on, I seldom read straight from their bio. But with yours, I have to do it because it's one of the most unique bios, backgrounds. Adrian Miller is a food writer, James Beard Award winner, attorney, certified barbecue judge who lives in Denver, Colorado. So first of all, who knew, Nevin, did you know that barbecue judges were certified?
To be honest, I've been a barbecue judge before and I'm definitely not certified, but there is a pro level like Adrian that goes out, gets the certificate. I don't know if you got a special pin to wear or anything, but
it's a little rip.
Knowledge is obviously way above mine.
Yeah.
So.
Oh yes. I got a badge. The City Barbecue Society, but there's several sanctioning bodies in barbecue. So it's much like boxing. So my dream.
So it's corrupt. It's corrupt.
So,
you're telling
me. So who's the Don King of barbecue?
Yeah.
That's what I aspire to be, man. I want to have the elastic belt for every single sanctioning body. That's my goal. But if I can speak to this question about what to pair with soul food and barbecue, there's only one acceptable answer, and that's some sort of red drink. And you have to understand, in African American culture, red is a color and a flavor. Black people don't get caught up in calling it cherry or strawberry or has hints of cranberry. It's just red.
That's right, red. And it can be any red, anything red.
Yeah.
I would just have...
Yeah, I would suggest a 2021 red Kool-Aid of some sort.
Nice.
Oh, I thought the 2020 had a little bit more nuance to it.
Are you allowed to spike the red drink?
Oh, yeah, sure. It just has to be colored red. That's all.
Okay. Okay, we can do that. Okay. Okay, but Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, that's where I was
born. I've read the book, and I've read a lot about you, and I've watched a lot of your interviews, so I kind of know this. But the second you say, oh, my God, this guy, Soul Food Barbecue, Denver, Colorado, they just kind of laugh at you and go, you know, come on, really? But get, right, tell us why you do have street cred.
Yeah, so, yeah, I usually lose it when I admit that. But my parents are from the South. My mom's from Chattanooga, Tennessee. My dad's from Helena, Arkansas. So even in an unlikely place like the suburbs of Denver, those are the food traditions I grew up on. And the great thing that my parents did was kept me tethered to the inner city of Denver, which actually there are Black people in Colorado and it has a sizable population. So they kept me tethered to the Black church and that Black neighborhood. And I really am grateful for that.
I have to say, Adrian, I have to say this all the time to people, no matter what city you're talking about, there's Black people in it. I promise you.
Thank you.
There's Black people in Salt Lake City. Yes, there are. There's lots of.
Now, we do have diversity in Denver. We have different kinds of white people, but there are Black people there. So,
all right. Some glossary terms. The difference between soul food and barbecue. Because you wrote a fabulous book on soul food, mm-hmm. which was the James Beard winner. And now you're writing Black Smoke, which is about barbecue. What's the difference?
Well, so soul food is really just one of the African heritage cuisines in the United States. Unfortunately, soul food has become shorthand for all African-American cooking, and that's not accurate. Creole food is different, the low country food. So it's really the food that African-Americans brought out of the South and transplanted in other parts of the country. When they're in an environment where they had limited menu from what they had in the South. So I say it's really the food of African-American migrants, and that's a twist. Because when you're in the South, people don't really call it soul food. They just call it country cooking or home cooking or just dinner.
Yeah.
Really outside of the South that this gets a name.
Hmm. Okay. So you were a lawyer, Stanford and Georgetown?
Stanford right? Undergrad, Georgetown Law School.
Okay. So why food and not law?
Well, it got to the point where I was singing spirituals in my office. And so I figured I needed to do something else. It just wasn't fulfilling for me. I mean, do you know how disparaging it is when even your white colleagues join in? You know, you're like, hey, yeah. How's things going? And somebody says, nobody knows. Nobody knows my sorrow. I actually was thinking about politics. I wanted to be the senator from Colorado for a long time, and I got to work in the Clinton White House.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get back to Colorado after that stint ended, but the job market was really slow. I was watching a lot of daytime television. I'm not even going to tell you what shows. And in the depth of my depravity, I said, you know, I should read something. I went to the bookstore. I found this book on the history of Southern food. And that author wrote that the tribute to Black achievement in American cookery has yet to be written. And that's what launched me on the journey.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about that journey, though, because you were watching TV and you saw something. Paula Deen.
Yeah. So 2004, I already know that I'm going to write this book on soul food. And originally I was going to include a chapter on barbecue because so many soul food joints have a barbecue option and so many Black run barbecue joints have soul food sides. Sure. But as I got more into it, I was like, nah, barbecue really needs to be its own thing. But I was still doing research and I'm watching Paula Deen's Southern Barbecue on the Food Network, hour long show. And when the credits are rolling, my mouth is agape because there were no Black people shown on that. And at first I thought, well, maybe I got it twisted, right? Maybe it was Paula Deen's Scandinavian barbecue sponsored by Alabama White Sauce. But then I just thought, well, what's going on? Why is this happening in 2004? Because I knew that barbecue was a vibrant part of African-American food traditions. And I knew that African-Americans had made significant contributions. So how do we get to a point where African-Americans are getting no love?
Mm-hmm. And that Paula Deen is trying to be the face or the historian of it. I mean, her cooking could never have been described as barbecue, you know. Right. Southern, yes. Soulful, no. Butterly, right. Yes. Right. Yeah.
You know, believe it or not, I don't actually blame Paula Deen so much because I've been on the other side with this production. It's really the production team because they're the ones who decide where you're going to go. They write out what she's going to say. So she was the star power, right? So it's really this production team. And as I looked at more shows, newspaper articles, and all this other stuff, it was the same thing going on.
Okay, but has anybody, I'm probably the only one, been to Pigeon Forge lately? Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, where Dollywood is?
No.
I've never been there.
First of all, it's on the bucket list, guys. You must put this on the bucket list. Dollywood, you must put on the bucket list. Pigeon Forge. So I was coming home from Gulfport, Mississippi a few months ago, and I've always wanted to go to Dollywood because I think Dolly is a goddess. And I had no idea about Pigeon Forge, which is the town, the city that has grown up around Dollywood. Hmm. And Dolly has done so much for the state of Tennessee. It's as big as Vegas. It's as crazy and gaudy and over the top as Vegas. There's a Titanic museum where it's a replica of the ship itself. It's insane. But then I'm out walking around and there's this whole Paula Deen village. And there are restaurants and dinner theater and stores. And I'm walking around talking to my husband on the phone saying, I thought she was gone. I thought we got rid of Paula Deen. But yeah, she's alive and well and doing much more successfully than she should. Much more. Yeah. That's
shocking.
Well, put Dollywood on your list. Okay. So Paula Deen was an inspiration. This is, Adrian, this book, Black Smoke, is a scholarly work. There's a ton of research in that. And tell us a little bit about the process of writing the book. And I was so fascinated that in the book, there are fabulous illustrations. There are recipes from some of the people you talk about, some of the famous people from the world of barbecue. But did you feel some pressure to really do all the fact checking that you could do and do all the historical background that you could find? Was it just fun? But tell us about the actual act of writing the book.
Yeah. So first of all, it was fun because I'm a nerd. So I'm into doing all this research and stuff. I proudly claim that. But yeah, I knew that I was saying stuff about barbecue that people had not heard before or may not believe. And so I wanted to document it. And that's the through line through all my work and soul food. I really gave full soul food a shine that I had never had. And I wanted to document that. And also my book on the presidential chefs. So to research this barbecue book, it actually, most of the research for all three of the books stem from the same process. So I read 3,500 oral histories of formerly enslaved people. And I looked for all references to food. And then I read thousands of newspaper articles because we have companies that are digitizing old newspaper and magazine articles. Talked to hundreds of people about the subject. And then because I care so much about my subject, I decided to eat my way through the country. So I went to 200 barbecues.
It's a sacrifice, but you had to do it.
Wow.
Yeah. It's rough. It's just rough.
Wait, how many restaurants?
I've been to over 200 barbecue restaurants.
Wow. Nevin, are you in awe?
I'm in total awe. And I was actually going to ask you, Adrian, you know, what is your methodology for deciding when you land in a town, which barbecue joints you're going to go to? Like, do you talk to the people that live there? Do you talk to your chef friends? Do you talk to fellow food writers? Like, what's your methodology? I'm always interested.
Yeah, all of the above. So I have a pretty good social media following and I'm engaged with them. So I usually put it out. I'm just saying, hey, I'm coming to this place. Do you recommend? And then I ask anybody if they want to eat with me. And I call these people barbecue research assistants. I'm always looking for them.
BRAs.
Yeah. And then I'll look at the local newspaper and I'll pay attention. I'll look at Yelp and all of these other, not because of I believe the reviews, but if someplace is heavily commented upon, I believe it's just someplace I should go to. And then I always try to leave a few days because when you get on the ground, man, you hear about all these spots that just don't show up in newspapers or on the web. And so that's usually the methodology.
So a couple hundred restaurants, how many different states do you remember?
So,
I mean, did you hit barbecue in Alaska is what I really care about.
No, but there is there's a black owned joint in Alaska. Cause as David mentioned earlier, there are black people everywhere. yeah. So I would say roughly 35 cities and 15 states.
Wow. Okay. Favorites that still stay with you. Some mentioned in the book.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I have a top 20 list in the book in case people are wondering. But, you know, places that I think about are Grady's Barbecue in Dudley, North Carolina, about an hour east of Raleigh. It's an older African-American couple in their 70s doing pork shoulder. Who knows how much longer they're going to be doing it. I love that place. I love the place in Kansas City called LC's. But Mr. Richardson died a couple months ago. I hear the family is keeping it going, and I hope to get back, you know, just make sure that things are still going well. And I also love a place called Dreamland Barbecue in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. There's another spot called Archibald's, which is as good or maybe even better. But the thing I love about Dreamland is you walk in and they just say, how many?
Nice.
And what they're asking you is how many spare ribs you want.
Right, right. Get
spare ribs, bread, white bread, and some sides, and then a drink.
Awesome. So this book, Black Smoke, it's a history book as much as it is anything else. And it's also, it's a bit of a myth buster. So I think if you ask most people, myself included, you know, where did barbecue come from? I'd say, oh, you know, it came from blacks. It came from enslaved people, those kinds of stuff. Correct us, because it starts with Native Americans, right?
Yeah. So, you know, let me just say, I wanted to prove unequivocally that black people invented barbecue, right? I wanted to do this and say Wakanda forever. But I had to be true to the documentation. And just looking at it, it looks like Native Americans were doing something that puts us on the road to pit barbecue. And it was different from the earlier accounts of barbecue right. in the Caribbean.
Can you describe illustrations from this part of the book?
So what Columbus and crew first see in the Caribbean in the late 1400s is a raised platform made of sticks over a very slow fire with fish, iguanas, and vegetation on top of that platform. And the idea was preservation. It was cooking it for a very long time. So, you know, they would say sometimes this would go on for a day or even longer. Mm. But pit barbecue was digging a trench, filling it with hardwood burning coals, putting whole animals over that butterfly. Somebody had to flip them and sauce them. So I kept wondering, well, how do we get from that pit barbecue away from that raised platform? Another method that Native Americans did, which was familiar to Europeans, was a spit. Now, they didn't have metallurgy, so this was all sticks, but they would create spits. They had piercing sticks where they would kill an animal and put strips of meat on a framework of sticks, bend it towards the fire and bend it back just to cook it, you know, depending on how fast they wanted to cook it. And then you have a vertical earth oven, which is a several foot deep hole. And you see that around in cultures around the world. And then they had a shallow pit. So it was just a depression in the ground.
Uh-huh.
And then sometimes wood and stones were, you know, set on fire, and then the meat was put right on top of that. So from that shallow pit and looking at the earth oven, I said Europeans show up, they see that, and they're thinking, okay, we want to supersize this. And so they get to the trench method. And then soon after that, enslaved Africans are thrown into the mix. So all three of these cultures, Native American, European, West African, are coming together with their ideas of smoking, seasoning and flavoring and all of that. And that gets us to Southern barbecue, because of all the early illustrations of barbecue, we don't see anything like Southern barbecue in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
We only see that in Virginia to start out, and then it spreads.
And it spreads following slavery, as you described in the book.
Right. Because old school barbecue is labor intensive, right? Yeah. So somebody had to dig that trench. Somebody had to clear the ground. Somebody had to chop the wood, burn it, kill the animals, process them. And prepare them, cook them, and then serve them food. And then even after all that was done, enslaved African Americans had to entertain the whites who had got there, who had gone to the barbecue. So it was a Black experience from the beginning to the end. In fact, by the time you get to the 1830s, you have newspaper articles describing authentic Southern barbecue, and they're saying a Negro man or colored man has to do X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
So slavery, blackness, and barbecue are all tied together. So by the, you know, in the 19th century, African Americans are not only barbecue's principal cooks, but they're barbecue's best ambassadors. Because after emancipation, anywhere in the country, if somebody wanted to taste a Southern barbecue, they were putting these cooks, these African American cooks, on trains, boats, stagecoaches to the far reaches of the country to do these barbecues.
Yeah, that's some of the most amazing stuff in the book, hearing about them. They were famous, and they would be written about, and they'd go to some governor's inauguration party with 15,000 people or something like that. So talk about some of the, there are great illustrations, great history, great stories about famous people in this world. So talk about, I'm going to pick random ones. Dave Anderson, yeah. Who's just legendary. And I want you to talk a little bit about him, and then I want to talk about the recipe of his you included. Because it was intimidating.
So Dave Anderson is the driving force behind Famous Dave's. And I wanted to include him in the book because I wanted to give a shout out to Native Americans. And I wanted to say that this Native American influence is not past. I mean, it's continuing. It's just that Native Americans don't get the recognition. And so very nice guy. You've seen him on TV. So he's very visible face. I don't know if he's actually associated with the business anymore. He may have been bought out, but he's the namesake for Famous Dave's. And so I wanted to include a recipe of his for ribs because I just, you know, spare ribs. I think if you talk to a lot of African-Americans, spare ribs is a real touchstone in African-American barbecue culture. So and all the recipes that I have in the book, they're 22. I tried to have enough to create a representative barbecue spread.
Right.
I wanted to have a chicken dish. I wanted to have ribs. I wanted to have brisket, you know. Alligator's a little bit of a twist, but yeah. You know, put that in yeah. there.
Yeah, you gotta get Florida in there. Okay, talk about Deborah and Mary Jones from Kansas City.
Oh yeah, so people may recognize those names from Queer Eye. They were featured last year. So they are in Kansas City, Kansas, and they carry on the barbecue tradition of their father, and they're just dynamos. It's a little small spot, but they just make incredible barbecue. And after appearing on that show, their business has just taken off. They've even got a booming barbecue sauce business. But the cool thing, one other cool thing about them is they have created a barbecue vending machine. So 24/7, you can get some sauce, some sandwiches, some entrees. I just think that's genius.
How do you
get one of those in D.C.? Come on.
Yeah.
I know, right?
You can get Mambo sauce. You can get Mambo sauce.
It's not the same.
Not quite the same as barbecue sauce, but you can't get Mambo sauce.
Oh my God. Okay.
Also, no, tomatoes are bad, right? Tomatoes are, that's not real barbecue sauce, right?
Only if you're from Eastern North Carolina.
Right.
Everywhere else, well, you know, there's some mustard traditions, but everywhere else, people accept tomatoes.
Yeah.
But old school, like, I mean, Virginia and North Carolina, there's like, what?
That's vinegar based, right? There's a vinegar based, yeah.
Yeah. When you get to Western North Carolina, that's where you have tomatoes. And it's interesting because you're seeing the gradual adoption and embracing of tomatoes because people thought they were poisonous because they're part of the nightshade family.
Right.
So that's why a lot of people didn't eat them. So over time, we see them embraced, and that reflects the movement of people at later times and saying, okay, we can put a little bit here. And then as you move further west, the tomatoes get more pronounced in sauces.
One of the things, many things I loved about this book, Black Smoke, is that, I think you, I'm going to butcher your words, but you said this isn't about some dying embers, and these are people who have gone away. You talked about how barbecue and blacks in barbecue is a living, changing, forward-leaning thing, right? And you wanted to talk about how they are really, I think you called them the experts and the ambassadors of barbecue, right? Talk about that a little bit, because it is a very forward-looking book. And for instance, one of the many myths you bust up is that barbecue is bad for you. Not necessarily, right?
Right. Right.
As much as I ate last night, it is, but.
So, yeah, you know, I really thought when I was writing this book that I was going to be writing an elegy about African-American barbecue.
Right.
And there may be fewer brick and mortar space places than there were, say, in the 60s and 70s. But the culture has just shifted. The brother or sister who's cooking on the roadside and the parking lot for their church, their family gathering, that's still thriving. And there are more food trucks. And so there's just other ways that this is in the mix. But, you know, part of the book, I would say there are two things. One is to celebrate African-American barbecue culture. And then the second is to restore African-Americans to the barbecue narrative and just say, look, if you're going to talk about barbecue in the United States, you cannot tell a complete story without including African-Americans. And unfortunately, the storytelling lately about barbecue has gravitated to four types of white dudes. You got the Bubba type, you know, the working class white dude. You've got the competition guy. You've got the hipster, you know, interesting facial hair, glasses, tattoos, piercings. And then you've got the fine dining chef who they have not been in barbecue in any serious way, except for the last 10 to 15 years. And, you know, the more the merrier, right? I say there's plenty of room to cook out for everyone. But the thing that's happening now is that as people are turning to white dudes as the barbecue experts, they are redefining barbecue away from an African-American aesthetic. So, you know, there are people walking around saying barbecue should be unsauced. I'm going to go out on a limb and say most black people would say, who says who? I've been at spots where you get your barbecue served in an ocean of sauce with little islands of smoked meat poking through because the sauce is the calling card. So to me, that's worry. And then about barbecue being bad for you. Yeah, everything in moderation. But, you know, what we see now is there is a trend towards healthier types of barbecue. So we're seeing a lot of people with fish. We're seeing more people, especially in African-American circles, more turkey. So in East North Carolina, instead of getting chopped pork, you're getting chopped turkey. And I'm telling you, except for a difference in color, you wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah.
Turkey tips, things like that. And then jackfruit, which is a fruit from Asia, big green fruit. And this is going to sound incredible, but if you talk to somebody who knows what they're doing, they can make jackfruit look, taste, and feel in your mouth, like in terms of texture, like pork.
Yeah. Nevin Martell, do you believe that?
I have. There's a Federalist Pig here in D.C., one of our, you know, BBQ joints. They do a jackfruit that's phenomenal. And you know, I love meat. I love vegetables. I'm an omnivore. And Adrian, you're right, man. I mean, what Rob does, it really feels so and tastes so meaty. And I think those are the kinds of bridges that carnivores need to eat more vegetables in their lives. If all things could taste as good as barbecue jackfruit, you know, in terms of vegetables, I think you'd see meat eaters eating a lot more vegetables.
Wow. Tori, no joke. There was a place in Boulder that was serving a jackfruit sandwich. Mm-hmm. It was a vegan convention down the street. They came to eat that place. He convinced them to try the vegan jackfruit barbecue. The vegans were sending it back and they were mad because they said, I told you we didn't want pork.
Wow. That's great. That's great. Something just flashed through my head and I cannot believe I just thought of this. So, you know, your four categories of the idiot white guys taking over the narrative. I'll give you another category. And this is the idiot white girl living in Georgetown in the 1980s.
Can't imagine who
decides that she's going to have in her little tiny backyard, she's going to have a pig roast, which is what we called it. Right. And because I worked on Capitol Hill at the time for John McCain, you do what anybody does from Capitol Hill and you reach out to the Congressional Research Service, which is set up to help members of Congress and their staff work on really serious issues. And I said, need information immediately on roasting a pig. So I got my congressional research packet, went to Eastern Market, Nevada, David and Claude, no Eastern Market, and had a great butcher shop, right? Said, I don't know how I came up with this number. I said, I need a 100-pound pig, 100 pounds.
What?
Had to be ordered. Said pig, I swear to God, I remember this, was slaughtered on a Wednesday, trucked on a Thursday. I picked him up in my little Subaru on Friday. And by the way, he was 110 pounds and he was big, took up the whole back seat of the car.
Sure.
And the party wasn't until Saturday. And we were very busy because the Keating Five scandal had erupted. So I was very busy. And I got 10,000 bags of ice in my bathtub in my little tiny Georgetown apartment. And the pig stayed overnight in the bathtub. But then I had my little Congressional Research Service and I knew what to do and I had to sew them up. Yeah. Right. That was not easy. And I had rented a spit, an electric spit, because I thought, I'm a genius. We're not going to be turning this thing, you know, as long as it's going to take to cook this damn pig. And I had the coals and this and that, whatever. Everything's going to be spectacular. I got some friends to help me put it on at, say, 4 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. And it was going to take all day. But I had the coals, had the fire. I had my friend Lorraine, David knows her. And she came over at about 7 o'clock in the morning, beautiful fall day. And we decided to help start the whole process. We were going to drink, I think it was apple cider and vodka. That was the bad move.
Sounds
like we got the fire going, we got the pig turning, and we get hammered. And we get so hammered that we forgot sometimes that the pig wasn't turning. Mm. So, and the fire was going out. So he'd get seared on the, maybe like one stripe. And like, oh, shoot. And then we'd have to start the whole thing again. And then I think we went to a soccer game and then we came back. Long story short, my last, you know, cogent recollection of the evening was about 10 o'clock at night. And I was being taken away from my party because I'd had too much apple cider and vodka. And Mark Salter, who had just started working for John McCain at the time and now is a world famous author, speechwriter, etc. And I have photographic evidence of this, is spraying lighter fluid on the pig, trying to light the thing to get right. Oh. The only reason 10
now
million
people far.
Did not die. What is it? You get strychnosis when you eat uncooked pork.
Yeah.
The only reason they didn't die is some Georgetown students who live nearby came over and just took over the whole thing, kept it going for another 12 hours. And then they took the pig and off it went. So that was it.
So please tell me that you still have that packet that the Congressional Research Service got for
you. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's all wrinkled and, you know, sauce all over it. What a nightmare. 110-pound pig is big.
Yeah.
A lot of slime.
Yeah, a lot of slime. Just a miracle nobody died. Okay, we got to let Adrian go in just a minute. Nevin, David, anything else for Adrian? Because I have a little homework for him at the end of our segment.
I loved, because I'm a history major, so I love history of all kinds. And I love the I didn't realize this because I'm not a foodie, so I don't read food stuff. I didn't realize it had been co-opted, but then I was like, everything else gets co-opted. Why wouldn't that be, right?
Yeah.
But I was fascinated by the whole notion of, and if you think about it, if it comes down, it always comes back to economics, but Black people who migrated up to the North, who worked in the slaughterhouses, kind of improvising and finding things that they could use to make food or to sell or to live on that other people didn't want. And I just wondered what your research told you about that.
Oh, yeah. No, that's one of the reasons why. So when we move, when America becomes increasingly urbanized, there's a shift from the whole animal cooking we've been talking about to focusing on lesser cuts of meat. And a lot of that is driven by people showing up in a place, these stockyards, butchers, they don't want to sell spare ribs or rib tips or whatever. And so you got cats just hanging out, waiting for the stockyard to close, then go in there, load up, wash it off and cooking it up. And so that fueled a lot of different traditions around the country, because a lot of the stuff we celebrate now that people are paying $30 a pound for was stuff that people didn't want to eat 100 years ago. Yeah. So, most notably spare ribs in Kansas City and rib tips in Chicago. Mm-hmm. What you were saying evoked those memories.
Yeah. Wow. My question for you is favorite three barbecue joints on the East Coast north of the Mason-Dixon line.
I'm gonna have to get back to you on that one. Wait, African American owned or just in general?
You know, take your, if it's easier to be in general, then sure. But if not, then African American owned.
Okay, so one that comes to mind is Home Team, I think it's called, in New York, mm-hmm. Brooklyn. That's pretty good. I liked Izzy's. That's kosher barbecue in Crown Heights. Mm-hmm. Oh, and if you count Chicago, yeah. So, like, there's Honey One Barbecue in Chicago. There's a lot of spots on the south side of Chicago. It should be recognized as its own kind of regional style, in my opinion. And then Ashley's in Milwaukee. I really like Ashley's Barbecue in Milwaukee. That was a good spot. And then Little Red's in Seattle. Really like that spot.
So talk about Denver. And one of the things I've read and I've seen you talk about is wanting Denver to have its own style. Barbecue. What are you trying to further there?
Yeah, and sorry, Nevin, I went all the way north instead of just the north. No,
it's okay. I know we don't have the richness of below the Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah. So Colorado has long been known for lamb and bison. So if you go to a knowledgeable butcher and ask for a Denver rack, they're going to give you lamb ribs. And for whatever reason, in the 60s and 70s, we just got away from it. So I just think it's just waiting for Colorado, especially Denver, to create its own signature style. So I've been reaching out to some folks and I'm saying, look, we should have a contest, get professional chefs and home cooks, come up with a signature dish. And the only way this works is people have to put it on their menus and make it at home. Because if just one place is making it, I don't think that defines a regional style. Although you can argue that happened in Memphis with Charlie Virgos and the dry seasoned ribs. I think a lot of people have to embrace it.
Nice. It could be like, it's the famous true story about how California wines really first made it in the scene. Was it called, it was in Paris, 1976. Mm-hmm. And an American over there set up this big competition. You could do that. You could set up this enormous competition. Adrian Miller, you are a lawyer. You're a food scholar. You're an historian. You're a great writer and you're a terrific guest. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, yeah. So good to be with you. It's been fun.
Wish you the best of luck. Come back with something else, okay?
All right. I'll work on
it. Thanks.
Good luck, man.
Bye. David and Nevin have to stick around.
Oh, we have to stick around. Okay.
You have to stick around. Okay, because I got some housekeeping. Hey, Claude, tell us again about Patreon.com.
Absolutely. Patreon.com/ChatterOnBooks. I am not only a participant, I am a member. I'm the first official member of the Chatter on Books Patreon.
Yay!
So you get all kinds of bonus content of the show. If you aren't a Patreon member, you didn't just hear the 60 more with our guest, Adrian Miller.
Yeah.
You've got to be a Patreon member to hear that. So go to patreon.com/ChatterOnBooks. So again, all extra content. You get to watch the show virtually once a month and join the virtual book club. Which will be lots of fun and all other kind of stuff. I mean, we'll keep adding, but you know, you've got to join it.
We'll probably cuss a lot on the.
Yes.
Good. That would be very good. Okay. A little bit of housekeeping and then Deserted Island. So download us, follow us in all the usual places. Send us any questions, comments, insults to info@chatterandbooks.com. We're back next week with PJ Vernon, author of a book called Bathhouse, HAUS. Nevin is shaking his head. Yes. Do you know PJ Vernon, Nevin?
No, but I'm excited to learn more.
Really, really interesting guy. A Chatter regular, Kathleen Barber, turned us on to him. Mm. And she is actually going to join us next week as well. But the New York Times Review about a week ago calls his book, Bathhouse, quote, a white knuckle ride to the dark side of love and infidelity. And it's creating lots and lots of buzz, which is great. Okay, Deserted Island. It's not a book. It's a favorite barbecue place. Nevin, I think I know yours, but you go first.
Wow. Well, you know, I'm going to go with Federalist Pig here in D.C.
Good one.
Rob is just a maestro of the pit. You know, every time I've been in one of his joints, I've walked out a happy, happy man. And I've been lucky enough to judge a couple of cooking competitions he's done, one with lamb, actually, which Adrian really appreciated. And, you know, his stuff was just like above and beyond the competition, like, you know, without even, you know, no one was close to him. And I always just know that I'm going to be so satisfied with his food. You know, it's got a lot of soul and it's got a lot of love in it. You know,
I think you need to get certified, though, because we love you. We know you know a lot, but it really brings you down a peg when we realize
I didn't know that I could have gotten certified. I mean, I've been certified a few other things, but you know.
Think about you could have gotten certified during the pandemic, all the time you wasted during the pandemic making sourdough bread. You could have gotten certified as a judge.
The thing is, I did so many other things during the pandemic that I'm so happy I did. But do you really think that they would have certified you? Like, what would you have done? You would have like Zoomed your barbecue? Like, I don't think so. I think that's like something you have to be hands on, face to face, you know, wet naps all around you, you know, that I don't think you can get a virtual barbecue, you know, judge certification by Zoom. That would be kind of crazy.
You did make sourdough bread during the pandemic.
Oh my God. I went so far down the sourdough rabbit hole. That was my one rabbit hole. The other rabbit hole was I learned how to forage for certain kinds of wild mushrooms. So I went for morels and chanterelles and chicken and head in the woods.
That can be a dangerous proposition.
It can be, but to be honest, like if you go out with the right people, you know, I'm looking for very identifiable mushrooms, and they don't really, they have like very obvious doppelgangers in this region. So, you know, I wasn't too worried that I was going to like make dinner and kill my family. But you know, it's a concern.
Brian and I recently were talking about, actually when we were in Greece, we were talking about the things many things we did during the pandemic, and then the things we didn't do. And we are among the very, very few people in the world who did not make sourdough bread. So we've decided that when the last American gets vaccinated, we're going to make sourdough bread. And then we're going to wrap it up and give it to all our neighbors and take it around and, you know, post on social media about it.
Well, since that's the marker, you know you're never going to do it.
Exactly.
So there you go.
Exactly. David Aldridge, favorite barbecue?
I have a couple. First of all, I'm pretty sure the Montrell's opened for the Supremes back in 65 at Monterey, didn't they? Hell of a group. There's a couple. In Kansas City, when I was there in the 80s, there were two barbecue places that kind of fought for supremacy in Kansas City. One was called Arthur Bryant's. And I went to Gates, and it was just heavenly, and it was fantastic. And the other one would be Central Barbecue in Memphis, Tennessee, which is just
nice.
Really good.
It's really good. You just sit there. There's so much. You could eat there for 5 hours if you wanted to. And I forgot to ask. I wanted to ask, how do people who do this not weigh 500 pounds, who just eat their way across the country? I never understood that.
I'm going to answer for him because, we didn't even talk about some of the recipes in the book. It's really hard work. To do what they're doing, and the two women we talked about from Kansas City, Deborah and I forget her sister's name. Yeah. They're up 18, 20 hours a day building the fire the way they want to build it, turning things the way there's no mechanization of this.
Yeah, I don't mean the chefs. I mean the people that go around the country eating and reviewing barbecue places.
I think they are. I think they're not. They're not starving.
Let's binge and purge, my friend.
Okay, I was going to say Arthur Bryant's, but then I have to do a shout out to John Sneddon and Rocklands here in D.C.
Let's say that.
As someone who's been here for 1,000 years, John Sneddon, God bless him, 1,000 years ago said he wanted a barbecue restaurant in D.C., and it was very hard to open a restaurant, so he started his takeout, and he has really built that into something. He's got a great team of people there, and it's really, really good food.
Yeah, they were catered our wedding rehearsal dinner. And I have to tell you, we had people from all over the country, all over the world come to that. And Rocklands knocked it out of the park.
Yeah.
Forever love them for that. I still, whenever I go in there, it's like, it's just great food. It's great food.
Okay, last story. I promise the last story. So because of the pig roast disaster in Georgetown in 1985, And then Brian and I started, it was late 80s. And Brian and I started dating, and then we got married, and we decided that we wanted to have a pig roast at our little house on Chestnut Street in Northwest DC. And it was going to be called the Azalea Pig Roast. And Brian said, on condition of our marriage staying together, that we had to outsource the pig roast.
Fair enough.
And so we found Rocklands, and they would do a whole pig and spectacular. So we love them. They're great. Okay, so the book is Black Smoke by Adrian Miller. Everyone should go out and buy it, even if you've already bought all your Father's Day gifts. It's really wonderful. Nevin, thank you for joining us. Stay well, my friend. Come back.
Thank you so much. It was so good to see all three of you. And
good to see you.
It was just such a wonderful time hanging with you as well.
Great to see you. David and Claude, thank you for everything as ever. And come back next week, people, and stay healthy. Thanks.